Airborne, the Junkers was more of an eagle than it appeared, but the plane shuddered in rough air, and the wing engine smoked and shot bluish-white sparks.
Drinking oil and fuel like a fiend! You'll be walking within 2 hours!
Just so we can reach our first fuel point!
Michael, sitting at a cramped navigator's table behind the cockpit, checked the maps. Their initial stop, a hidden airfield operated by the German resistance, lay just south of Denmark. The second stop, tomorrow night, would be at a partisan field on the northern tip of Denmark, and their final fuel point lay within Norway. The distances looked huge.
Never make it, Goldilocks! I saw those parachutes back there!
He jerked a thumb toward the cargo bay, where their packets of food, canteens, winter clothes, submachine guns, and ammunition were stored.
They're made for babies! You expect me to jump out of this crate wearing one of those? You're insane!
As he talked, Lazarus's eyes scanned the darkness, searching for the telltale blue sputters of Nazi night fighter engines. He knew, however, that they would be hard to see. By the time he saw, one of the bullets would be on their way. He cringed at the thought of what heavy machine guns would do to this flimsy cockpit. And so he kept talking to hide his fear, though neither Chestnut nor Michael was listening.
I'd have a better chance of surviving if I jump for a haystack!
Little more than 2 hours later, the starboard engine began to miss. Chestnut watched the needles of the fuel gauges settle towards zero. The Junker's nose kept wanting to sink, as if even the plane itself was in a hurry to get back on the ground. Chestnut's wrists ached with the effort of holding the Junker steady. Before long, she had to ask Lazarius to help with the controls.
She flies like a battleship!
An arrow of fire appeared on the ground. Friendly flames pointing toward their first landing strip. Lazarius took the Junkers in, circling down over the arrow. Over the next 18 hours, the Junkers was refueled and the engines oiled as Lazarius took charge of the ground crew. Most of them farmers, who'd never been within 100 yards of an airplane. Lazarius got hold of some tools, and under the protection of a camouflage net, he probed into the starboard engine with grimy relish. He made a dozen small corrections. When midnight came again, they were in the air, crossing from Germany into Denmark. One's darkness was the same as the other's. Lazarius again took the controls when Chestnut got tired and blasted bawdy Russian drinking songs against the incessant rough music of the engines. Chestnut hushed him by pointing to a streak of blue passing about 5,000 feet overhead. The night fighter, probably a new model Heinkel or Dornier, she told them, judging from its speed, was gone to the west within seconds. But the sight of such a predator took away Lazarius' desire to sing. On the ground in Denmark, they were treated to a banquet of fresh potatoes and blood sausage, a meal that particularly satisfied Michael. Their hosts were again poor farmers, who had obviously been preparing the feast as if for the arrival of royalty. Lazarius' bald dome caught the attention of a little boy, who kept wanting to feel it. The family's dog sniffed nervously around Michael, and one of the women present was thrilled because she recognized Chesna from a picture in a dog-eared magazine about German film stars. Stars of another kind greeted them as they flew over the North Sea on the following night. A meteor shower shot bolts of red and gold through the darkness, and Michael smiled as he listened to Lazarius laugh like a child. When they landed, they stepped out of the plane into the chill of Norway. Chestnut broke out their parkas, which they slipped on over their gray-green commando outfits. A British agent, who introduced himself as Craddock, was among the Norwegian partisans who met them. They were escorted by reindeer sled to a stone cottage where another feast was laid out. Craddock, a sincere young man who smoked a pipe and whose right ear had been shot off by a German rifle bullet, told them that the weather was closing in farther north and they could expect snow before they reached Uskadal. The broadest woman Michael had ever seen, obviously the older daughter of their host family, sat close beside Lazarius, watching him intently as he chewed on an offering of salt-dried caribou meat. She had tears in her eyes when they left the next night on the final leg of their journey, and Lazarius clutched a white rabbit's foot that had somehow gotten into his parka. These were only a small fraction of the millions of human beings whom Hitler had decided were not quite a step above beasts. The morning of May 16th came, with snow that whirled out of the darkness against the cockpit windshield. The airplane pitched and yawed, buffeted by strong winds over the jagged mountain peaks. Both Lazarius and Chestnut gripped the steering yokes as the Junkers rose and fell hundreds of feet. Michael could do nothing but strap himself in and hold on to the table, sweat dripping under his arms, his stomach lurching.
Ice on the wings! Oil pressure's dropping on the port side engine! The temperature's coming up fast!
Oil leak! We've ripped a seam!
The Zargis reached to the control panel and cut back the power on the left wing engine. Flame spat from around the engine cowling. The propeller seized up and froze.
Now we'll find out what she's made of!
The Junker's nose descended. The Zargis pulled it up again, his gloved hands clenched on the yoke.
Jenkins, hold it!
You'll have to!
Chesna did, putting her back and shoulders into it. Michael unbuckled his seat straps and leaned over, gripping the yoke with her. He could feel the immense trembling strain the aircraft was under, and as wind sideswiped the plane and slewed it to the left, he was slammed up against the cockpit bulkhead.
Strap in! You'll break your neck!
Michael leaned forward again, helping Chesna hold the plane's nose as steady as they could. Lazarius glanced at the port wing engine and saw streamers of red fire flung back from the blistered cowling. The Junko slewed to the side again. Lazarius realized with a start of pure horror that the cockpit floor had split open right under his legs.
Let me have her!
He pushed the yoke forward and nosed the Junkers into a screaming dive. Michael saw the altimeter needle spinning crazily. He couldn't see anything beyond the windshield and the snow, but he knew the mountains were there, so did Chesna. The aircraft fell. The Zargis watched the broken engine. The fires were going out, extinguished by the wind. When the last flicker of flame had gone, he wrenched back on the yoke as the muscles in his shoulders popped. The Junkers were slow in responding. His wrists and forearms were in agony. Chesna took hold of the yoke and pulled back on it too. Then Michael added his power, and the Junkers obeyed. The altimeter needle leveled off, just below 2,000 feet. Chesna gestured to the right, at a point of fire through the snow. She turned the plane toward it and continued to let the altitude slowly fall. Another point of fire sparked, then a third.
That's the airstrip!
A fourth fire began to burn. Oil cans flaming on either side of the landing field.
We're going in!
She pulled back on the throttles, her hand shaking, and Michael quickly strapped himself into his seat. As they approached the flame-lit field, Chesna straightened the wings and cut the remaining two engines. The tires hit earth, bounced, hit again, a smaller bounce, and then Chesna was standing on the brake, and the Junkers was leaving a plume of snow and steam behind it as it rolled across the field. Lazarus peered down between his legs, where he saw a crack of snow about 6 inches wide. He was the first out of the airplane. As Chesna and Michael emerged, Lazarus was walking in dazed circles, reacquainting his feet with solid earth. As Michael and Chesna were unloading the supplies, a battered white-painted truck pulled up beside the Junkers. Several men got off and began to unroll a huge white tarpaulin. Their leader was a red-bearded man who gave his name as Herx and proceeded to help load the knapsacks, submachine guns, ammunition, and grenades into the truck. As Herx worked, the other men labored to get the tarpaulin over the Junkers.
We almost went down! That storm almost knocked our damned wings off!
What storm? This is springtime!
Michael and Chesna turned toward the airplane. The flame-blackened port wing engine hung off its mount for a few seconds, then the last few bolts broke, and the entire engine crashed to the ground.
Welcome to Norway! Hurry it up! Get that thing covered!
The men worked fast, spreading the tarpaulin over the Junkers and staking it down with white ropes. Then, with the passengers and the other Norwegians in the truck, Herx got behind the wheel and drove them away from the landing strip toward the seacoast, about 25 miles to the southwest. The sun silvered the sky to the east as they drove through the narrow, muddy streets of Uskadal. It was a fishing village, the houses made of gray wood and stones. Thin creepers of smoke curled from chimneys, and Michael smelled the aromas of strong coffee and bacon fat. Down where the rocks met the slate-colored sea, a small fleet of boats chugged out on the dawn tide. Nets rigged up and ready. Here and there, Michael noted a figure watching through half-drawn shutters. Chesna elbowed him in the ribs and motioned out toward the harbor. A big Blommenfoss flying boat, a swastika painted on its tail, was skimming the smooth surface about 200 yards offshore. It made two slow circles of the fishing fleet, then gained altitude and vanished into the low-lying clouds. The message was understood. The Nazi masters were watching. Herx stopped the truck in front of a stone house.
You get off here. We'll take care of your goodies.
Neither Chesna nor Michael liked the idea of leaving the guns and ammunition with a man they didn't know, but neither did they wish to risk the weapons being found if the village was inspected by the crewmen of that flying boat. Reluctantly, they got off the truck.
You go in there.
Perks pointed toward the house. Its door glistened with a shellac of dried seal blubber.
Rest. Eat. Wait.
He put the truck into gear and drove away through the mud. Michael opened the door and entered. The inside of the house was gloomy and smelled of fish and dried mud. Nets hung from the walls, and here and there a crooked picture clipped from a magazine was stuck on a nail. A small fire glowed at the center of a cast-iron stove.
Hello? Anyone here?
On an old brown sofa was a large mound of dirty clothes. The mound had begun to quiver, and as the new arrivals watched, they saw it sit up.
Say, the Peter's ghost. What is that?
Whatever it was, it reached for a bottle of vodka on the floor beside it. A large brown hand uncorked the bottle. The mound rose up to well over 6 feet.
Welcome! Welcome!
She came toward them, into the stove's ruddy light. The woman had to be 250 pounds, if an ounce, and perhaps 6 feet 2 inches tall. She approached them, a wobbly mountain on legs.
Welcome!
Her broad, wrinkled face grinned, displaying a mouth that held 3 teeth. She had the almond-shaped eyes of an Eskimo, yet her eyes, set in nests of wrinkles, were pale blue. Her skin was coppery brown, and her lank straight hair, cropped as if beneath an oversized bowl, was a brassy orange. The commingling, Michael realized, of generations of Eskimo and Nordic genes, battling for dominance. She was quite an extraordinary-looking woman, standing there grinning and wrapped in folds of multicolored blankets. Michael judged her to be in her late 40s or early 50s, given the wrinkles in her face and the gray amid the orange hair. She offered the vodka bottle.
Welcome!
Welcome!
Lazargi snatched the bottle from her hand and swallowed the clear fire.
Ah.
Michael pried the bottle out of his fingers and returned it to the woman, who licked the next rim and took another slug.
What's your name?
Chesna spoke German. The woman shook her head. Chesna pressed a hand against her breastbone.
Chesna? Michael? Lazaris?
Ah!
The woman nodded gleefully. She pointed between her massive thighs.
Katie! Welcome!
A man could get in a hell of a lot of trouble around here.
The cabin, if not exactly clean, was at least warm. Michael took off his parka and hung it on a wall hook while Chesna tried to communicate with the huge, rather tipsy Eskanordic. The best she could do was understand that the woman lived here and that there were plenty of bottles of vodka. Herks closed the door behind him.
Well, I see you've met Kitty.
Kitty grinned at him, drank the rest of the bottle, and flopped down on the sofa.
She's a bit hard on the furniture, but she's pleasant enough. Who's in charge among you?
I am.
All right. Kitty, hunarvin du harventipo. Divil stoppa tiskana po scarpa.
Kitty nodded, her grin gone, and stared at Chesna.
I've told her who you are. She's been expecting you.
She has. I don't understand.
Kitty's going to take you to Scarpa Island.
What? She's a drunk.
So? We're all drunks up here nowadays. Kitty knows the water, and she knows Scarpa Island, too.
You're saying that if we want to get to Scarpa, we have to put our lives in her hands.
That's it.
Scarpa! Scarpa, dirty bad! Nazi boys!
Besides, it's Kitty's boat. She used to be the best fisherman for 100 miles around. She says she used to be able to hear the fish sing. And when she learned their songs and sang back, they swam into her nets by the ton.
I'm not interested in singing fish. I'm interested in patrol boats, searchlights, and mines.
Oh, Kitty knows where those are, too. Kitty used to live on Scarpa Island before the Nazis came. She and her husband and 6 sons.
Yeah.
The vodka bottle landed in the corner, near three others. Kitty dug into the folds of the sofa, and her hand emerged, gripping a fresh bottle. She pulled the cork out with her remaining teeth.
What happened to her family?
The Nazis, shall we say, recruited them to help build that big son of a bitch chemical plant. They also recruited every other able-bodied person from Kitty's village. And Kitty herself, of course, since she's strong as an ox. They also built an airfield and flew in slave labor. Anyway, the Nazis executed everyone who did the work. Kitty's got two bullets in her. They hurt her sometimes when the weather turns really cold. Coffee will have to be black, I'm afraid. We're out of cream and sugar.
Herks went to the stove and began to pour coffee for them. It came out thick and sludgy.
Kitty lay with the corpses for 3 or 4 days. She's not exactly sure how long it was. When she decided she wasn't going to die, she got up and found a rowboat. I met her in 42 when my ship went down with a torpedo in the guts. I was a merchant marine seaman, and thank God I got to a raft.
Herx gave the first cup to Chesna, then offered her some shortbread.
What did the Nazis do with the bodies?
They left them for the wolves.
Herx offered the box to Michael.
Biscuit?
Along with the muscular coffee and the shortbread, Herx produced a packet of dried leathery mutton that Michael found tasty, but Chesna and Lazarys had difficulty swallowing.
We'll have a good pot of stew tonight. Squid, onions, and potatoes. Very tasty, with a lot of salt and pepper.
I won't eat a squid.
Lazarys shrugged off his parka and sat down at a table, his coffee cup before him.
Them things look like a cock after a night at the Moscow whorehouse. No, I'll just eat the onions and potatoes.
There was a movement very fast behind him.
Don't move!
Kitty's huge bulk fell over him like an avalanche.
Yeah!
Her blade slammed into the scarred tabletop, between Lazarys' outstretched second and third fingers. It missed the flesh, but Lazarys jerked his hand to his chest. Kitty wrenched the knife out of the tabletop and did a merry dance around the room like a massive and deadly whirligig.
She's mad! Absolutely mad!
I'm sorry. When she drinks, she has this little game she likes to play. But she always misses. Most of the time, that is.
Herx held up his left hand. Part of the third finger was severed, up to the knuckle.
Oh, for God's sake, get that knife away from her!
Kitty was already folded up around it, swigging down more vodka. Michael and Chesna stuffed their hands into the pockets of their jumpsuits.
It's important we get to Scarpa as soon as possible. When can we go?
Kitty? Narkandi go till Scarpa?
Kitty thought about it for a moment, her brow knitted. Michael, Chesna, and Lazarys stared at the door for a moment, then looked back at Herx. He smiled blandly and rocked back on his heels. Lazarys rubbed a hand over his face. When Kitty returned, her feet covered with mud, she grinned.
I morgen kväll. Det vill vara en storm I kväll och tak för ögonen.
Tomorrow night. She says there'll be a blow tonight, and fog follows wind.
By tomorrow night, I might be down to the stumps.
Lazarys buried his hands in his pockets until Kitty returned to the sofa.
You know, there is something we all ought to be thinking about. If we get on that island, do whatever it is you heroic types are supposed to do, and get off with all our body parts, then what? In case you haven't noticed, our Junkers has lived up to its name. I couldn't put that engine back on even with a crane. And anyway, it's burned to a crisp. So, how do we get out of here?
The question wasn't one that Michael hadn't already considered. He looked at Chesna and saw she had no answer for it either.
That's what I thought.
But Michael couldn't let that problem contaminate his mind right now. Scarpa had to be reached and Dr. Hildebrand dealt with first. Then they'd find a way out, he hoped. Norway would not be a pleasant place to spend the summer with the Nazis hunting them down.
Herc's got the vodka bottle away from Kitty and passed it around. Michael allowed himself one fiery sip, and then he stretched out on the floor, his hands wedged in his pockets, and was asleep in just over a minute. Kitty's boat slid through the mist. The water parted before the figurehead, a wooden gargoyle with a trident, and a shielded lantern illuminated the interior of the wheelhouse in dim green. Kitty's hands, broad and coarse, were delicate on the wheel. Michael stood beside her, watching through the dripping windshield. Kitty had been drunk for most of the day, but as soon as the sun had begun to set, she put aside the vodka and washed her face in icy water. It was past 2 o'clock on the morning of the 19th, and Kitty had pulled the 40-foot weather-beaten relic out of its harbor slip about 3 hours before. Now, here in the wheelhouse, she was silent and brooding, with no trace of the grinning, drunken woman who'd greeted them in Úskadal. She was all deadly business. She had been right about the blow on the night of the 17th. A fierce wind had rushed down from the mountains and screamed over Úskadal until dawn. But the houses were built for such caprices, and there was no damage except to the nerves. She was correct as well about the fog that had crept over Úskadal in the bay, blanketing everything in white silence. How she could steer in this soup, he didn't know. But every so often she cocked her head and seemed to be listening. Surely not for the singing of fishes, but for the sound of the water itself, telling her something it was not in his power to understand. She made minor corrections of the wheel from time to time, as gently as nudging an infant. She suddenly reached out and grabbed Michael's parka, pulling him closer and pointing. He couldn't see anything but fog, though he nodded. She let him go and steered in that direction. Herx had stayed in Úskadal, a stranger to travel by water since the U-boat torpedoing of his freighter. Lazargis was no line of the sea either, but fortunately the water was glassy and the boat's progress smooth, so Lazargis had only heaved twice over the side. Perhaps it was his nerves, or perhaps it was the reek of fish that clung to the boat like a miasma. Chesna entered the wheelhouse, the hood of her parka up over her head and her hands in black woolen gloves. Kitty kept staring straight ahead, guiding the boat toward a point the others couldn't see.
How's Lazargis?
Conscious.
Lazargis was down in the cramped little cabin, which Michael had noted was even smaller than the kennel at Falkenhausen. Chesna peered out at the fog.
Where are we?
Hell if I know. Kitty seems to, though, and I guess that's what matters.
Kitty turned the wheel a few degrees to starboard, and then she reached down to the greasy throttles and cut the engines.
Go!
She pointed forward. Obviously, she wanted Michael to watch for something. He took a flashlight from a corroded metal locker and left the wheelhouse with Chesna following. On the bow, Michael stood over the figurehead and probed with the light. Tendrils of fog wafted through the beam.
Hey, what happened to the engines? Are we sinking?
Quiet!
Lazargis came forward, guiding himself along the rusted railing. Michael slowly swung the flashlight beam from right to left and back again.
What are you looking for? Land?
Michael shook his head because he really had no idea. And then the flashlight hit a faint, ill-defined object off on the starboard side. It looked like the rotten piling of a dock, with gray fungus growing all over it. Kitty had seen it too, and she guided the bow toward it. In another moment, they all could see it, perhaps more clearly than they'd wished. A single piling had been sunk into the muck. Bound to that piling by rotting ropes was a skeleton, immersed up to its sunken chest. A bit of scalp and gray hair remained on the skull. Twined around the skeleton's neck was a noose of heavy wire, and attached to the wire was a metal sign with faded German words.
Attention, entry forbidden.
In the light, small red crabs scuttled in the skeleton's eye sockets and peered out between the broken teeth. Kitty corrected the wheel. The boat drifted past the grisly signpost and left it in darkness. Not 20 yards from the piling and skeleton, the flashlight beam picked out a floating gray ball covered with kelp and ugly spikes.
It's a mine! A mine!
Kitty knew where it was. She veered to port, and the mine rolled in the boat's wake. Michael's stomach knotted. Chesna leaned forward, gripping the portside railing, and Lazargis watched for more mines on the starboard side.
One over here!
It bobbed and lazily turned, encrusted with barnacles. The boat slid past it.
Here!
Michael spotted the next one, almost dead ahead. Lazarji scrambled back to the wheelhouse and returned with another flashlight. Kitty kept the boat at a slow, constant glide, weaving among the mines that now appeared on all sides. Lazarji thought his beard would turn white as he watched a mine, its spines covered with kelp, drift over the crest of a swell almost in their path.
Turn, Tammy, turn!
The boat obeyed, and Lazarji heard the mine scrape across the hole. The last of the mines floated away on the starboard side, and then the water was free of them. Kitty rapped on the windshield, and when she had their attention, she put a finger to her lips and then drew it across her throat in a slashing gesture. The meaning was clear. In a few minutes, a searchlight appeared through the fog, sweeping around and around atop its tower on Scarpa Island. The island itself was still invisible. Michael could hear heavy machinery at work in the chemical plant. He switched off his flashlight, and so did Lazarji's. They were getting close to shore. Kitty turned the boat, staying just outside the searchlight's range. A patrol boat was circling the island. The searchlight skimmed past them, dangerously close. Michael saw the glint of smaller lights through the murk that looked like bulbs on outside catwalks and ladders, and the dark shape of a huge chimney that rose into the mist. He could make out the hazy forms of buildings. Kitty was guiding them along Scarpa's rugged coastline. Soon, they left the lights and the sound of machinery behind, and Kitty veered the boat into a small, crescent-shaped harbor. She knew this harbor and took them straight to the crumbling remains of a seawall. She killed the engine, letting the boat drift across silvery water at the base of the wall. Michael switched his light on and made out a barnacle-crusted dock just ahead. The rotting prow of a long sunken boat jutted up from the water like a strange snout, and hundreds of crabs clung to it. Kitty emerged from the wheelhouse.
Bind the boat into brig, ya!
She motioned to the dock, and Michael jumped from the boat onto a platform of sodden timbers. Chestnut flung him a rope, which he used to tie the boat to a piling. A second rope, thrown from Kitty, completed the task. They had arrived. Stone steps led up from the dock and seawall. Beyond them, Michael saw by the flashlight beam, was a cluster of dark, dilapidated houses. Kitty's village, now occupied only by ghosts. Chestnut, Michael, and Lazarji checked their submachine guns and strapped them on. Their supplies, rations of fresh water, dried beef, chocolate bars, ammo clips, and 4 grenades apiece, were in backpacks. Michael, in his previous examination of their supplies, had also noted something else wrapped up in a little packet of waxed paper. A cyanide capsule, similar to the one he'd popped into his mouth on the roof of the Paris Opera. He hadn't needed it then, and he would die by a bullet rather than use one here on Scarpa. Their equipment ready, they followed Kitty up the ancient steps into the dead village. She probed ahead with a flashlight she'd taken from Lazarji's, the beam revealing a rutted main road and houses covered with wet mold as white as ash. Many of the roofs had collapsed, the windows without glass. Still, the village was not entirely dead. Michael could smell them, and he knew they were close by.
Welcome.
Kitty motioned them into one of the sturdier-looking houses. Whether this one had been her home, Michael didn't know. But it had become a home again. As they crossed the threshold, Kitty's light speared through the mist and caught 2 skinny wolves, one yellow and one gray. The gray one leapt for an open window and was gone in an instant. But the yellow wolf wheeled on the intruders. Michael grabbed Lazarius's arm before the Russian could fire.
No!
The wolf backed toward the window, its head held high and fire in its eyes. Then, it abruptly turned, lunged up into the window frame, and out of the house.
Did you see those things? They'll tear us to pieces. Why the hell didn't you let me shoot?
Because a burst of bullets would bring the Nazis here about as fast as you could reload. The wolves won't hurt you.
Nazi boys, nasty. Wold, not much so. Nazi boys make dead. Wold, yom dead. Such done.
This house, wolf droppings on the floor and all, would be their headquarters. Most likely, Michael reasoned, the German soldiers who guarded Hildebrandt's chemical plant were as fearful of the wolves as Lazarji's was and wouldn't come here. Michael let the others start unpacking their gear.
I'm going out to do some scouting. I'll be back as soon as I can.
I'm going with you.
No, I can move faster alone. You wait here.
I didn't come with you to...
Argue, and that's not why we're here. I want to get in closer to the plant and take a look around. Better 1 scout than 2 or 3, right?
All right. But for God's sake, stay low.
I plan on.
Outside, Michael strode briskly along the road and away from the village. Woods and sharp-edged boulders began about 70 yards east of the last house and ascended toward Scarpa's Heights. He knelt down, waiting to make sure Chesna hadn't followed him, and after a couple of minutes, he unstrapped his gun, took off his backpack and his parka. He began to undress, his skin rippling in the chill. Naked, he found a secure niche to wedge his backpack clothes and schmeisser into, and then he sat on his haunches and began the change. As a wolf, he stretched, getting blood into his muscles, and he began to lope nimbly over the rocks above Wolftown. After he crested the ridge, it was a half-mile jaunt through dense forest before he smelled the reek of men. He was going in the right direction. Other aromas crowded into his senses. The bitter smell of exhaust from the plant's chimney, the smell of wet steam, hares and other small animals quivering in the woods at his passage, and the musky perfume of a young female. When he glanced that way, he caught just the quickest glimpse of Yellow. She was keeping pace with him, probably made a little nervous with curiosity and his own male aroma. He wondered if she'd witnessed his change. If so, she'd have interesting tales to tell her pack. The bitter smell got worse, and so did the man reek. The yellow she-wolf began to lay behind, intimidated by the nearness of humans. After a moment, she stopped. He understood the message. Don't go any closer. He wouldn't have cared to if he'd had a choice about it, but he kept going. About 15 yards later, he came out of the woods, and there was Hildebrandt's creation, rising like a dirty mountain beyond a chain-link fence topped with barbed wire. Smoke chugged from a massive chimney of gray stones. Around it were concrete buildings, connected by catwalks and pipes that snaked through the place like one of Harry Sandler's mazes. The thumping noise was coming from somewhere at the center of the complex, and lights shone through the shutters of windows. Alleys wound between the buildings, and as Michael watched, on his belly at the edge of the woods, a truck turned a corner and rumbled away like a fat beetle into another alley. He saw several figures up on the catwalks. Two workmen twisted a large red flywheel, and then a third checked what looked like a panel of pressure gauges and signaled an okay sign. Work was going on here around the clock. Michael got up and slinked along the fence. Soon he made another discovery, an airfield complete with hangars, a fuel tank, and fueling trucks. On the field, lined up in an orderly row, were three night fighters, a Dornier DO-217 and two Heinkel HE-219s, all with nose radar prongs, and a wicked-looking Messerschmitt BF-109 day fighter. Overshadowing everything on the field was a huge Messerschmitt ME-323 transport aircraft, its wingspan over 180 feet and its length almost 100 feet. The Nazis were obviously doing some serious business here. For now, though, there was no activity on the airfield. Beyond the field, the cliffs of Scarpa fell to the sea. Michael returned to the forest's edge and chose his spot. He began to dig a hole beneath the fence. For this task, a wolf's paws were superior to human hands. Still, the ground was full of small rocks, and it was strenuous work. But the hole grew, and when it was large enough, Michael pressed his belly to the earth and clawed himself under the fence. He stood up on all fours and glanced around. No soldiers in sight. He ran into the nearest alley, heading toward the heartbeat of the shadow's silence. He heard a truck coming before it turned into the alley behind him, and he leapt around a corner and flung himself flat before the headlights found him. The truck passed. In its backwash, Michael caught a sour odor of sweat and fear, a zoo-like smell he associated instantly with Falkenhausen. He got up and followed the truck at a respectful distance. The truck paused before a long building with shuttered windows. A corrugated metal gate was drawn up from within, and harsh light spilled out. The truck pulled into the portal, and a few seconds later, the corrugated metal began to clatter down again. Michael's gaze found a ladder running up the building's side to a catwalk about 20 feet above. The catwalk continued along the center of the roof. There was no time for deliberation. He found a group of oil cans nearby and crouched behind them. When When the change was done, and his white skin tingled with a cold, he stood up, ran to the metal-rung bladder, and quickly scaled it. The catwalk went on to the next structure, but on this building's roof, there was an entry door. Michael tried it, and the knob turned. He opened the door and found himself in a stairwell. He emerged into a workshop of some kind, with a conveyor belt and hoists just below the roof. There were stacks of crates and oil drums, and a couple of heavy load-pulling machines standing about. All the activity was down at the other end of the long building. He carefully wound his way through the equipment and crouched down behind a rack full of copper tubing.
This man can't work! My God, look at those hands! Palsied like an old woman! I said, bring me men who can use saws and hammers!
Michael knew that voice. He looked up from his hiding place and saw Colonel Yerrick Block. The hulking boot stood beside his master. Block was shouting into the face of a German officer who had flushed crimson, and to their left stood a skinny man in the baggy gray uniform of a POW. The prisoner's hands were not only palsied, they were gnarled by malnutrition. Beyond those four men stood seven other prisoners, five men and two women. On a large table were bottles of nails, an assortment of hammers and saws, and nearby a pile of timbers. A truck, flanked by two soldiers with rifles, was positioned near the metal gate.
Oh, take this wretch back to his hole! We'll have to use what we've got!
As the officer pushed the POW back to the truck, Block put his hands on his hips and addressed the others.
I trust you're all well and eager to work, yes?
There was no response from the prisoners, their faces pale and emotionless.
You gentlemen and ladies have been selected from the office because your records indicate a familiarity with carpentry. We are therefore going to do some woodcraft this morning. 24 crates, built to the specifications as follows.
He withdrew a piece of paper from his pocket and unfolded it.
32 inches in length, 16 inches in height, 16 inches in width. There will be no deviations from this formula. These crates will be lined with rubber. The points of all nails will be blunted once they are hammered in. All rough edges will be sanded to a uniform smoothness. The lids will be double-hinged and padlocked instead of nailed shut.
He gave the list to Boots, who went about nailing it up on a bulletin board for all to see.
Moreover, these crates will be inspected at the end of 16 hours. Any not passing my inspection will be broken, and its creator made to begin anew. Questions?
He waited. Of course, there were none.
Thank you for your attention.
Block strode toward the metal gate, with Boots right behind him. The gate was being drawn up by the two guards. The truck driver was backing it out with the officer and the palsy POW aboard. Block did not attempt to hitch a ride on the truck, but he and Boots followed it out, and then the metal gate was closed again.
Get to work, you lazy shits!
When all the prisoners were moving, sluggishly, their minds and bodies beaten, the two guards sat down at a table and began to play cards. Michael slipped back to the stairwell the way he'd come, ascended to the roof, and then to the ladder again. His joints throbbed with the stress of so many changes within such a short time, and his muscles were sore, but he was ready to run again. He came out from his hiding place and sniffed the air. Through the multitude of scents, he found the lemony tang of Yerrick Block's hair pomade, and that was the trail he followed. He turned a corner and saw Block and Boots walking briskly just ahead. He followed them, slinking low.
24 crates. Lined with rubber.
What would go into those crates? It had occurred to him that the crates were about the size needed to hold a small shell, rocket, or bomb. The big transport plane out on the runway must be here to carry the loaded crates to wherever Iron Fist was hangared. Michael's blood pounded in his veins. He had the killing desire. Taking Block and Boots would be a simple matter here in this alley, though both men wore holsters and pistols. It would be a balm to the soul to tear Boots' throat out and spit in his face. But Michael held himself back. His mission was to find out where Iron Fist was, and what kind of horror Dr. Hildebrandt had created. First the mission, then he would feed his desire. He followed the men to a two-storied concrete blockhouse near the center of the plant. Again, the windows were shuttered. Michael watched as Block and Boots climbed a metal staircase and went through a second-floor doorway. The door closed behind them. Michael crouched down, waiting to see if they'd come out. But the minutes ticked past, and they did not. It would be dawn in 2 hours. It was time to get back to Wolftown. Michael returned to the place where he dug his way in. This time he dug the hole deeper so a human body might crawl under. Dirt flew from beneath his claws, and then he eased beneath the fence and ran into the woods. The yellow wolf, who thought herself crafty, came out of the underbrush and followed off to the side. Michael outdistanced her, wanting to reach his equipment and change before she could get too close. On two legs, dressed and with his backpack on and the Schmeisser strapped to his shoulder, Michael sprinted along the road, back through Wolftown. Chesna rose up from where she'd been hiding behind a wall of crumbling stones, a machine gun aimed at the approaching figure. It was Michael she saw in another moment. He had dirt all over his face.
I found the way in. Let's go.
The journey from Wolftown to the plant was harder on human legs than on wolfen, Michael soon learned, as he, Chesna, and Lazarius went through the woods. The yellow wolf had brought her companions. Kitty had remained behind to watch the boat, and also because her bulk would have slowed their progress to a crawl. Michael went under the fence first. Lazarius followed. Then Chesna crawled under, the mind turning over the question of how Michael had dug such a hole without a shovel. In the shelter of an alley, they stopped to remove extra ammo clips and two grenades from their packs. The clips went into the pockets of their parkas, while the grenades were latched to the Schmeisser straps. Then they went on, staying close to the wall, with Michael in the lead. He guided them toward the building where the prisoners were working. The two guards would be easy to overcome, and information about the plant could be gotten from the guards and the prisoners. Still, Michael took nothing for granted. Each step was a careful one, and each turn a challenge. Near their target building, Michael heard someone approaching and motioned Chesna and Lazarius down. He knelt at an alley corner and waited. One soldier was about to round the corner. As soon as Michael saw the man's knees, he came up off the ground in a burst of power and drove his gun butt against the soldier's chin. They dragged him into a recessed doorway and left him there folded up like a package. Michael, Lazarius, and Chesna had reached the workshop building's roof. They went along the catwalk and down through the stairwell. Michael led them through the jumble of equipment, and in another moment they could see the two soldiers engrossed in their card game. The prisoners were working on the crates, proud of their carpentry skills, even under the Nazi thumb.
Wait!
Michael crept closer to the guards.
Four aces! Ha!
The guard with a winning hand spread his cards out on the table.
Beat me!
As you wish.
The second man went for his rifle, but he froze when the Schmeisser's business end kissed his throat.
On the floor. Get on your knees. Hands cupped behind your head.
The soldier complied. Very quickly, Chesna and Lazarius emerged.
Don't kill me, please. I'm just a nobody.
We'll make you a no head in a minute.
Lazarius pressed his knife blade to the man's quivering Adam's apple.
He can't answer questions through a cut's throat.
Chesna put the barrel of her gun against the soldier's forehead and pulled back the cocking bolt.
I think we have his attention.
Michael glanced over at the prisoners, who had stopped working and were mesmerized with surprise and bewilderment.
What's going into those crates? I don't know.
You lying bastard.
Lazarius put some pressure on the blade, and a trickle of warm blood ran down the guard's throat.
Bombs! 100-pound bombs! That's all I know!
24 of them? A bomb for each crate?
Yes! Please don't kill me!
They're being packed up for transport? In the Messerschmitt, out in the field?
Yes!
Transported to where?
I don't know!
More pressure from the blade.
I swear I don't know!
What's inside the bombs?
High explosives! What's inside any bomb?
Don't get cute. Just answer the questions.
That fool doesn't know. He's just a guard.
They looked to see who'd spoken. It was the frail prisoner who had gray hair and wore wire-rimmed glasses. He came a few steps closer.
It's a gas of some kind. That's what's inside the bombs. I've been here for over 6 months and I've seen what it can do.
I have too. It burns the flesh.
Burns the flesh? Oh, it does more than burn the flesh, my friend. It eats the flesh like a cancer. I know. I've had to burn some of the bodies, my wife among them. But she's in a better place than this. They torture me every day by forcing me to live.
The man looked at the hammer he held and then dropped it to the concrete. He wiped his hand on his trouser leg.
Where are the bombs stored?
That I don't know. Somewhere deeper in the plant? There's a white building next to the big chimney. Some of the others say that's where the gas is made.
The others? How many prisoners are there?
84. Wait. Danelka died 2 nights ago. 83. When I first came here, there were over 400, but... Have you come to save us?
No.
Then it's the gas, is it? You're here because of that? Well, that's good. We're already dead. If that stuff ever gets out of here, I shudder to...
That was the corrugated metal gate.
Hey, Reinhardt! Open up!
He's calling me!
No, he's not. He's Carlson. Reinhardt is on the floor.
Reinhardt! Open up, damn you! We know you've got the pretty one in there!
A female prisoner, her black hair framing a face as pale as a cameo, picked up a ball-peen hammer, her knuckles bleached around the handle.
Come on, be a sport! Why hunger all for yourselves?
Tell them to go away.
No, they'll come in the way we did. On your feet! To the gate, move!
Michael followed the Nazi, and so did Chesna. Michael pressed his gun into the man's spine.
Tell them to wait a minute. Wait a minute!
That's better! You bastards thought you were going to sneak one by us, didn't you?
The gate was hoisted by a chain and pulley device operated with a flywheel. Michael stepped to one side.
Pull the gate up. Slowly.
Chesna got out of the way too, and Carlson started turning the flywheel. And at that moment, Reinhardt, who'd been shamming for the past 2 minutes, suddenly sat up at Lazarus's feet. He reached up for the wall beside their card table. Lazarus stabbed downward with a knife, sinking it into Reinhardt's shoulder. Reinhardt's fist punched a red button attached to electrical cords on the wall. The gate was a quarter of the way up when the alarm began. Michael could see four pairs of legs. Without hesitation, he clicked off the safety on his gun. Two soldiers dropped. Carlson released the flywheel and tried to scramble beneath the corrugated metal as it clattered down again, but a burst from Chesna's gun ripped him open. Lazarus repeatedly sat down on Reinhardt, fear strength behind the blows.
Get out while you can! Go! Go!
There was no time to deliberate. That siren would bring every soldier in the plant down on them. Michael ran for the stairwell, with Chesna a few paces behind, and Lazarus bringing up the rear. They came out onto the roof, and already two soldiers were running along the catwalk toward them. Their rooftop was turning into a hornet's nest.
I'm hit, damn it!
She was clutching her right ankle, blood on her fingers. Michael bent down to help her to her feet. They had no choice. They had to get back down the stairwell before they were cut to pieces in the crossfire. Michael pulled her to the stairwell door. As they got into the stairwell, slugs marched across the door and knocked it off its hinges. Michael felt a searing sting of pain in his left hand, and he realized a bullet had just gone through his palm. His hand went numb, the fingers twitching involuntarily. He kept hold of Chesna, and they all backed down the stairwell to the workshop. Two Germans entered at the top of the stairs, and Lazarus took aim. More soldiers crawled into the stairwell. Lazarus drew a grenade. Michael, Chesna, and Lazarus were already in the workshop, where the prisoners had taken cover under the equipment at oil drums. Soldiers scurried down to the bottom of the smoky stairwell and fired into the workshop. Michael looked over his shoulder toward the metal gate. More Germans were trying to wrench it up by hand from the other side, their fingers curled under the edge. Michael released Chesna, who fell to her knees. His hand was streaming blood, the wound a perfect puncture. He fired beneath the gate, and the Germans scrambled away from it.
Ceasefire! Ceasefire!
Michael crouched down behind a half-track load puller, and Chesna and Lazarus knelt in the shelter of oil drums.
Baron, it's time you and Chesna threw out your weapons. It's over.
Michael glanced toward Chesna, and their eyes met.
Baron, you're not a stupid man. Certainly not. You know by now that this building is surrounded, and there's no possible way you can get out. We will take you one way or the other. Chesna, dear, surely you understand your situation. Throw out your weapons, and we'll have a nice talk.
Chesna examined the blue-edged hole in her ankle. Her thick woolen sock was wet with blood, and the pain was excruciating. A cracked bone. She fully understood the situation.
What are we going to do?
Chesna got her backpack off and unsnapped it.
Baron, you amazed me. I'd like to know how that escape from Falkenhausen was engineered. You have my deepest respect.
Michael saw Chesna reach into her pack. Her hand came out with a square of waxed paper. The cyanide capsule.
No!
Lazarus grabbed her arm.
There's another way.
You know this not.
She began to unwrap the packet. Michael crawled across the floor to her.
Chesna, we can shoot our way out. And we still got grenades.
My ankle's broken. How am I gonna get out of here? Crawl?
I'll carry you.
Yes, I believe you would.
She touched his cheek, ran her fingers across his mouth.
But it wouldn't do any good, would it? No, I'm not gonna be caged and tortured like an animal. I know too much. I'd be sentencing a dozen others to...
Something clattered across the floor about 15 feet away. Michael looked toward it, his heart pounding, and saw that one of the soldiers in the stairwell had just thrown a grenade. Chalky white smoke began to pour from it, except it wasn't smoke, Michael realized. It had a sickly, sweet, orange-like odor. The smell of chemicals. A second gas grenade popped near the first one. Chesna, her eyes already stinging and watering, lifted the cyanide pill to her mouth. Michael couldn't bear it. For better or worse, he swiped the capsule out of her hand. The chemical smoke settled over them, like the folds of a shroud. A figure appeared through the smoke before him, a soldier wearing a gas mask. He aimed his rifle at Michael's head. Chesna slumped beside Michael, her body twitching. Michael fell over her, struggled to rise again, but his strength was stolen. Whatever the chemical was, it was potent. And then, with a reek of rotten oranges in his nostrils, Michael Gallatin blacked out. They awakened in a cell with a barred window overlooking the airfield. Michael, his wounded hand bound with bandages, peered out into silvery daylight and saw the big transport Messerschmitt still there. The bombs hadn't been loaded yet. All their equipment and their parkas had been stripped away. Chesna's ankle was bandaged as well, and when she peeled the bandages away for an inspection, she found that the wound had been cleaned and the bullet removed. Michael had a killer headache, and all Lazarius could do was lie on one of the thin mattressed cots and stare at the ceiling like a drunkard after a vodka binge. Michael paced the cell, stopping every so often to look through the wooden door's barred inset. The corridor was deserted.
Hey! Bring us some food and water.
A guard came a moment later, glared at Michael with pale blue eyes, and went away again. Within an hour, two guards brought them a meal of thick, pasty oatmeal porridge and a canteen of water. When that had been consumed, the same two soldiers wielding submachine guns appeared once more.
Out! Now!
Michael supported Chesna as she limped along the corridor. Lazarius stumbled, his head fogged, and his knees as soft as taffy. The guards took them to another large building, not far from where they'd been captured. They were taken to a conference room. Its sole occupants were Colonel Yerrick Block and the ever-present Boots.
Hello, Chesna. I'm so glad to see you.
Boots took a step forward, but Block stopped him with a raised hand.
No. It's all right.
Block withdrew a handkerchief from his pocket and wiped the spit from his cheek.
Such spirit. You're a true German, Chesna. You just refuse to believe it.
I am a true German, but I'll never be the kind of German you are.
The difference between winning and losing is a vast chasm. You are speaking from the bottom of that chasm.
Dr. Hildebrand certainly seems to rule this outpost with an iron fist.
Oh, don't start that again. Haven't you gotten tired of barking up that trail yet?
No. I haven't found the trail's end. The only thing I don't know is where the fortress is hanged. Iron Fist. That's the name of a B-17 bomber, isn't it?
Baron, you continually amaze me. You never rest, do you?
I'd like to know. Iron Fist, where is it?
Near Rotterdam, on a Luftwaffe airfield.
Rotterdam? Not France after all, but German-occupied Holland.
Almost 1,000 miles south of Scarpa Island. Michael felt a little sick, knowing that what he'd suspected was true.
That said, I'll add this. You and your friends, and that bearded gentleman down there I haven't been introduced to, and neither do I wish to be, will remain here on Scarpa until the project is concluded. I think you'll find Scarpa a more difficult nut to crack than Falkenhausen. Oh, by the way, Chesna, turnabout is fair play, don't you agree? Your friends got to Baumann. My friends got to one of the gentlemen who met your plane near Uskadal. As a matter of fact, I've been on Scarpa for a week, tidying up affairs and waiting for you. Baron, I knew where you would go when you got out of Falkenhausen. It was just a question of how long it would take you to get here. Our radar watched you weave through the minefield. That was nice work.
Kitty, what happened to her?
I think you'll find the stockade more roomy than your quarters at Falkenhausen, though. You'll get a nice fresh sea breeze, too.
And where will you be? Getting a suntan up on the roof?
Oh, not quite, Baron. I'll be getting prepared to destroy the Allied invasion of Europe.
Really? Is that your weekend job?
It will take much less than a weekend, I think. The invasion will be destroyed approximately 6 hours after it begins. The British and American troops will be drowning each other trying to swim back to their ships, and the commanders will go mad with panic. It will be the greatest disaster in history, for the Reich's enemies, of course, and a triumph for Germany. And all that, Baron, will happen without our soldiers having to fire a shot of our precious ammunition.
All because of Iron Fist and Hildebrand's corrosive gas. 2,400-pound bombs won't stop thousands of soldiers. As a matter of fact, your troops are more likely to get gas blown back in their faces. So tell me, what asylum were you recently released from?
Oh, no! Oh, my dear Baron, Cessna, neither of you know, do you? You think bombs are going to be dropped on this side of the channel?
Michael and Cessna looked at each other. A horror like a knot of snakes began to writhe in Michael's stomach.
You see, we don't know where the invasion is going to be. There are a dozen possibilities. Oh my, what a surprise. But you see, it doesn't matter where the invasion is. If it happens this year, it's going to happen within the next 2 to 4 weeks. Then it begins. We're going to drop those 24 bombs on London.
No German bomber could pierce England's aerial defenses. The Royal Air Force was too strong, too experienced since the Battle of Britain. No German bomber could get anywhere even remotely close to London. But an American B-17 Flying Fortress could. Especially one that appeared to be a cripple, shot full of holes and returning from a bombing mission over Germany. In fact, the Royal Air Force might even give the struggling craft an escort. How would the British fighter pilots know that the bullet holes and battle damage had been painted on by a Berlin street artist?
Those 24 bombs have a center of liquid carnagene within a shell of high explosives. Carnagene is the name of the gas Gustav's created, and it's quite an accomplishment. He'd have to show you the equations and the chemical notations. I don't understand them. All I know is that when the gas is inhaled, it triggers the body's own bacteria. The microbes that cause the decay of dead tissue. The microbes, in a sense, become carnivorous. Within 7 to 12 minutes, the flesh begins to be, shall we say, eaten from the inside out. Stomach, heart, lungs, arteries, everything. It's fantastically concentrated. What's contained in those 24 bombs is enough to kill, at a rough estimate, 30,000 people, depending on the prevailing winds and rainfall.
My London, why don't you just drop your bombs on the invasion fleet?
Because, dear Cessna, bombing ships is an unprofitable undertaking. The targets are small, the channel winds unpredictable, and carnagene doesn't get along well with sodium, as in salt water.
You want to hit London so word can be communicated to the invasion troops. When the soldiers hear about what the gas does, they'll be paralyzed with terror.
Exactly. They'll all swim home like good little fishies and leave us alone.
A panic amid the landing troops would end all chances for success. There was no way the soldiers wouldn't hear about the attack on London. If not over the BBC, then over the Scuttlebutt network.
Why only 24 bombs? Why not 50?
The B-17 we have can only hold that many. It's enough for the purpose. Anyway, the next batch of carnagene isn't refined yet. It's a long, expensive process, and one mistake can destroy many months of labor. We'll have some ready, though, in time to perfume your comrades from the east.
The 24 bombs contained all the carnagene that was ready for use, but it was more than enough to destroy D-Day and strengthen Hitler's grip on the throat of Europe.
By the way, we do have a target in London. the bombs will fall along Parliament Street to Trafalgar Square. Perhaps we can even get Churchill as he smokes one of those disgusting cigars. We won't see each other again. I will have other projects after this one. You see, this is a feather in my cap. Chestnut, you have broken my heart.
Locke's smile faded as he placed a long, thin finger beneath her chin. She twisted away from him.
But you're a wonderful actress, and I'll always love the woman in your films. Guards, will you take them back to their cell now?
The two soldiers came forward. Lazarus stood up, dazed. Michael helped Chestnut to her feet.
Goodbye, Baron. I trust you will have a good relationship with the Commandant of the next prison camp you're in.
Once that cell door shut on them, they were finished. So too were 30,000 or more of London's citizens, and possibly the Prime Minister himself. Finished also was the invasion of Europe. It would all be ended when the cell door shut. Michael supported Chestnut as they made their way through the facility. Lozayis walked a few paces ahead, the soldiers a few paces behind. They were going through the alley toward the stockade. Michael could not let that door shut on him again, no matter what.
Stumble and fall.
Michael bent to help her as the two soldiers moved forward.
Can you take one?
She nodded. He pulled Chestnut up, then suddenly twisted his body and flung her at the nearest guard. Her fingernails went for his eyes. Michael grabbed the other soldier's rifle and up-tilted it. The soldier almost got it away from him until Michael drove his knee into the man's groin. As the soldier doubled over, Michael wrenched the rifle away. Lazarus blinked, his mind still sluggish from the gas grenades. He saw Chestnut clawing at the soldier's eyes and the man trying to hold her off. Lazarus took an uncertain step forward. He stopped, looked up, and saw another soldier on a catwalk above. Michael aimed at the soldier, but his wounded hand betrayed him. The shot missed. The other guard thrust Chestnut aside.
Run! Go!
The half-blinded guard, his eyes bloodshot and watering, swung his rifle in Michael's direction. A Galachinov ran. Behind him, the guard wiped his eyes and took aim. Lazarus landed on top of him and fought to get the gun away. The soldier on the catwalk tracked his prey with his own rifle. Something smashed against the side of Michael's head. Michael fell, his momentum skidding him across the pavement on his belly and crashing him into an area of trash cans and broken crates. He pressed his hand against his right temple, feeling warm wetness. His brain felt soggy, as if the shock had liquefied it.
Got to get up. Got to run.
As he pulled himself to his knees, a second bullet hit a can only a few feet away. He got up, his head pounding with fiery agony, and he staggered through the alley to where he thought the fence must be.
The fence. Got to crawl under it.
He rounded a corner, and almost directly into the path of an oncoming truck. It shrieked to a halt, but Michael hugged the wall and started running again. He turned another corner, lost his balance, and slammed into the wall. He fell, darkness beginning to call him, and he crawled into a narrow doorway and lay there, shivering with pain.